You want a shed for your yard. Do you shell out the cash for a prefab or do you build it yourself? It's Home Improvement Day today on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, will be here this hour. If you want to build a shed from a kit, there are a lot of options out there. We'll find out how to pick a good one. Or maybe you're a little more ambitious and you want to build a shed from scratch. We'll find out what you need to know before you get started and talk about recycled materials that you might want to consider using. Bill will also answer your questions about the projects on your to-do list. 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This time of year, a lot of us start daydreaming about the kinds of things we'll be doing outside when the weather gets warmer. And a spring project that a lot of us take on is building a shed for the yard. Today, we'll get some advice on how to make a plan. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is on the phone with us today. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Charity. I can't help but chuckle listening to Elmer Fudd in the other room with advisory.
Oh, Bill.
I got to get Dennis once in a while. That was great.
All right, moving right along. And yeah. Bill is joining us on the phone today because of the winter storm, so he didn't make the trek into the studio.
No, had too much coffee already. So.
clearly. Yeah. All right. Now, Bill, if you decide you want to build a shed, there are a lot of kits available that you can buy.
Right.
Is that a route you would recommend?
Well, it kind of depends on your skill level. Some of the kits, are fairly complicated. Some of them are very simple. It just kind of depends on what look that you want to have. You know, if you just want to have a small, say, a 6-foot by 8-foot, basically a storage shed, maybe a little garden shed at the same time. They're fairly simple, but then when you get into something that you want to have more maybe personality into it, something that kind of stands out and you really like looking at it rather than you're looking out at this, little square thing that doesn't have any flair to it. There's where it's going to have to maybe have some extra thinking going on. And sometimes the kits are okay. Sometimes they aren't. The simple ones, they're very good at. So if they get into more complicated structures, you're almost just as easy to go ahead and maybe draw up something of your own or have a friend draw up something that, this is something you're going to have a lot of money in. I mean, you can go ahead and buy a kit for, those little metal things for like $400 or, some of the 8x12 cedar kits are, close to $5,000. So, if you're going to spend that kind of money and you're going to be looking at it out, maybe your living room window or something, you might want to have something that really matches your personality. So, if you're going with a little bit bigger one, then you might want to just go ahead and draw up something of your own. And the nice thing is most lumber yards are going to give you the materials that you're going to need for that kit anyway. And a lot of smaller lumber yards will go ahead and cut everything for you. So you're basically getting a custom kit.
All right. Now, with the more complicated kits, do you need to have a skill set to match?
You should have somebody on site that maybe has a little bit more, maybe a carpenter around, at least on call. Most of the kits, the hardest part is maybe, measuring and doing some angles if they don't come pre-cut already in those parts. But if you have a carpenter around or a friend, maybe they can just go ahead and we call it laying out the plates, like all the parts that you nail the vertical studs onto, the top and the bottom plates. They can mark all those out, and then all you do is just, okay, you put the boards between these two lines and put two nails in it here and two nails here, and maybe they can do the custom cuts for the rafters if you're going to be making, regular rafters, or they can lay out the trusses and maybe make a jig for you. They're kind of doing the technical side, and it usually doesn't take very long for that. And then you yourself can go ahead and assemble everything. I remember years ago, The person wanted a wood foundation, just went over there and spent a few minutes laying out all the plates and said, okay, here's where you nail. They built their whole foundation, and then on a Saturday morning, a bunch of friends went over, and we assembled it and lowered the house back on it. But they did all the work. I mean, as long as somebody maybe lays out some marks for you.
Okay, so you think maybe I don't need a kit. I want to build something kind of cool.
Right.
Of course, you want it to last, too.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things that you really need to get right?
Well,
if you want a sturdy shed.
If you want a sturdy shed, you want to make sure and keep it where it's going to be dry. You know, if you're going to put a shed in the yard, first of all, you know, you may want to think, check with your neighbors, for one thing. You know, some areas have covenants and some towns, they'll only allow you a certain size, or it has to look a certain way, and it can only, you know, only have a certain siding and roofing. You know, you get all that stuff out of the way, and your neighbors are going to be fine with kind of maybe what you've sketched out. You want to make sure you put it in an area where it's dry, not the, maybe the lowest part of your yard, you know, where it gets wet. So you would probably have all of the wood that's close to ground would be all treated lumber, that especially if you're going to put it on, say, like skids, like 6x6 timbers, they would be made for ground contact, you know, or being in the ground. But all the wood up above, you know, can just be normal. They call it SPF, spruce pine fir lumber, like white wood. But on the outside, that's, you know, that's what's going to be open to the elements. So that's where it comes down to, you know, what you really want it to look like. Do you want it to be, you know, maintenance-free, and then you put vinyl siding or something like that on it? Do you want it really neat, like a regular garden shed would be, and have maybe cedar on the outside, which then you can either stain it or let it weather. But you want to pick out products that are going to last, because you don't want to be spending your time doing maintenance on the garden shed. The house is enough, but the garden shed be something that you build and you leave alone. So a lot of people in a garden shed, they want it to blend in, and that's basically what a garden shed would be back in a, you know, maybe a corner or an area next to your garden, and maybe it collects rainwater for you. So you want it to kind of fit in to the elements. So you would probably use cedar, which is a little bit more money, but yet you could just let it weather and you don't really have to do any maintenance to it.
Now, the thing that really gets me thinking in the spring, and this time it was an issue, the most recent issue of the Iowan Magazine has a spread on some unique garden sheds, and they're all made with reclaimed materials, and they are just stunning.
Yeah.
And of course, if you Google garden sheds made with reclaimed materials, you will come across the most awesome pictures.
Yeah.
And they're so exciting. But, okay, give me some words of caution before I get carried away there.
Don't go with the one that's a circle. It looks like an acorn. Don't go with that one or the one that's made out of car hoods. I found those, too. But when you're looking at, you know, like recycled materials, years ago, some students from Iowa State University, architectural students, Bruce Basser was their instructor, and they, you know, he said, hey, let's have them, you know, build something. So they helped build a house, but a group of the girls got together, and they said, we want to build this really neat garden shed out of recycled materials. And they poured concrete for a slab, but then everything up above it was lumber from some buildings that have been torn down, the front door, this really cool oak door that I recognized all of a sudden. Hey, they got that out of my barn.
You were saving that for something.
Yeah, I was. But it looks cool. But then to let a lot of ventilation in, they were able to find some metal from an old grain bin. You know, they have floors in them that are ventilated with all these holes, and they used those on the top of the shed, top of the wall, so you'd get a natural breeze, but it was under the overhang of the roof, and so you didn't get rain in, and then it also let in a lot of natural light. And then they built a roof that was, they call it a butterfly roof. It's actually the low part of the roof is in the center, and the outside edges went up, so the water would run to the middle of the roof, and then it went out the back and went to a rain garden. They collected all that water. And all of that, you know, except for the actual roofing on the top, was completely, you know, recycled or, you know, reclaimed lumber from different job sites. The problem sometimes, though, is when we get into especially anything with glass or old doors, a lot of them have maybe a lot of lead paint on them. Mm. And so we'd have to, you know, repaint to keep, you know, people from getting in contact with the lead.
Sealing the lead in.
Yeah, and then the glass, a lot of times it's very brittle, and you never want, you know, any of these old windows from barns and that in an area where they can be, you know, broken very easily, like close to the ground or where you're moving tools around. You know, those should be more of a tempered glass or, you know, plexiglass. And then, you know, sometimes in these pictures, they must never have hail because they're putting, you know, like old barn sashes up on the roof, which would, you know, wouldn't make one summer.
Right.
In Iowa. So, you know, you have to really remember a lot of these pictures come from all over the country, and a lot of them wouldn't work in Iowa. But, you know, using old doors is a pretty neat style. You know, they're already close to maybe the height you want. You know, they're usually like 6 foot, 8 inches tall. So you could, you know, some of the neat pictures are, they just find a bunch of old doors and pay a dollar for them and put them together. But there again, you want to check with your neighbors
and make sure they think that looks cool,
too. Are they
going
to like that, or is it, you know, all of a sudden you're going to see a bonfire some Saturday night in your backyard? You know?
Well, the ones with windows, I think, are really appealing to a lot of gardeners because then you can create a garden shed that can also double as a greenhouse. And it looks like somebody just fit these puzzle pieces together. They collected old windows from, you know, wherever.
Yep.
You have to make a plan, right?
You do. You have to draw some sort of a plan. You know, I'm of the old world where I just grab a wood ruler and, you know, do quarter inch equals 1 foot. But, you know, most normal people now will get on SketchUp or something on computer and draw them up. But you have to have a plan because, you know, because the first thing is once you lay out what you have on the ground, you're stuck to that profile. And if you haven't sketched it up, maybe you've got all these doors that you want to use, and all of a sudden, okay, now my dimensions won't allow me to use the doors that I have without cutting one in half or something like that. You want to spend a lot of time on drawing it out. And sometimes, you know, what some people will do, and I know it sounds kind of silly, but sometimes people will get a bunch of cardboard and they'll actually build almost a full scale of the shed with cardboard and tape it together and get a feel for the size.
If I was going to go to all that work, I'd just keep that shed.
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
No, that may not hold up very well.
Put a couple pieces of paint on it, a couple coats of paint, and it'll hold up for a year.
All right. So although these seem really appealing, and I think that they appeal a lot to people who don't have a lot of experience building, you do need to have some skills. You do need to have a plan, and you need to work this out ahead of time.
Yeah. And like I say, if you have someone around that's fairly handy, you know, this is something you can build this time of year inside, build the walls in maybe in your garage, and you can draw it out on your, you know, your garage floor, you know, of a wall, and then build those lines. And you know, it's just open to your imagination. If you just have someone maybe that knows how to run a construction master calculator, if anybody's ever going to do anything around the home of doing their own construction, that'd be one of your best investments as a construction master calculator. It can help you figure, you know, dimensions and angles. And
all right. Well, Bill, we have to take a short break.
Oh, no, already? Okay.
Already. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. You can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here with us today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start with a question from Mallory in Des Moines. Hi, Mallory.
Hi. I had a question. My home is 102 years old, and I need to do some tuck pointing. And there seem to be a multitude of opinions about what mix up to put in there. And I just wanted to know, is there really one right formula for that?
You know, that's a really good question, because that is a lot harder than what it seems, because houses or any buildings that age, you know, a lot of them use different types of mortar depending on the type of brick that's on the outside. And sometimes if you use the wrong mortar, what will actually happen is the brick faces then will start blowing off because the moisture gets behind this harder type of mortar. What you really want to do is you want to get a hold of someone that is heavily involved into restoration work, like masonry restoration, or someone that's done tuck pointing for a long time, someone that has a lot of references, because it's pretty easy to take a home and, you know, ruin the outside of the house with the wrong type of mortar. Some are too hard, sometimes they're too soft. And a lot of projects are going to have to maybe grind out like maybe an inch or inch and a half and re-tuck point everything, not just, you know, where there are, you know, failures now. Because the last thing you want to do is ruin the house. And then you want someone also that has the ability to match, if they're going to tuck point certain areas, to be able to mix the mortar correctly so when it does dry, and it takes a long time for it to reach its final color, that it is going to match and it just doesn't stick out. You know, you see a lot of houses where there's some bright white repairs done and the original mortar is almost a dark gray and it, you know, it just looks terrible. So you want to find somebody with a lot of experience, and most of them now are in the restoration area.
Okay.
Does that help?
A bit, yeah.
But you can, you know, actually, if you just Google masonry restoration, there almost every major city has someone that specifically is good at that. You want to get a lot of references, you really do, so that you can drive by and see their work.
Okay, yeah. I was really hoping to do it myself. But,
oh, well, then.
It scared me even more.
If that's the case, there's I think it's American Restoration. I'm just pulling it out of the sky, but I think that's what it's called. A site where you can go, and there are some places. If you search hard enough, you're going to be able to find a place where they will actually take a sample of your mortar, and then they can analyze it and tell you basically what the original mix was, and then you can try and match that. But if you're going to do a lot of it, you may want to consider having someone professional do it, because there is a lot to the mix that has to be just right.
Okay. And on a quicker note, I think,
I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit, Mallory. Can you try one more time?
Yeah, I said on a quicker note, is there any success in getting a tree vaccinated for the emerald ash borer?
Oh, I think that's not Bill's area of interest, but you can give us a call on Friday on Horticulture Day and ask about that. Not this Friday, but the next Friday. Mallory, thank you so much for your call. And Dale is on the line next in Norwalk. Hi, Dale.
Hi. Hey, Bill, I've got a question for you. At the last two home shows we've recently had in Des Moines here, Energy Doctor out of Ankeny was there touting their perforated aluminum foil blanket for the attic.
Okay.
And I went online, you know, I talked to him and all this, and I went online to look for, you know, an analysis of the benefits and stuff. And really, I couldn't find anything other than, you know, very subjective anecdotal testimonials by homeowners, which, you know, I don't consider very formative.
Sure. Sure.
What's your opinion about this stuff?
Well, the easiest way for me to tactfully get out of this one is to go to the Department of Energy or the EPA. The Department of Energy has Google Department of Energy radiant barriers, and the ones that we have when we do presentations came right from the Department of Energy. And if you are in southern Iowa, you might get a $10 per year. You might save $10 per year, but that depends on the type of house, what color the roof is, which way it faces. You may not be anything. Minneapolis or northern Iowa is like $5 a year savings. The problem with even a perforated aluminum foil is as vapor goes through any air leaks, that's the biggest thing, is any air leaks that you have in your ceiling where there's lights or lights, receptacles, wires going in the attic, that warm air goes up and it's not smart. It doesn't know that it has to go left, right, or whatever direction to go out a hole, you know, even though it's perforated. Aluminum foil is the best vapor barrier there is. And in Iowa, the last place you want to put a vapor barrier is on top of your thermal barrier, which would be your insulation in your attic. You know, that's the best thing to, I mean, I personally have a lot of opinions on it, and I can't say them on the radio, so your best thing to do is just go to the Department of Energy and take a look at. And that's all factual. There's some from the laboratories out. Boy, I wish I could remember. Oak Ridge Labs. Oak Ridge National Laboratories have done a lot of studies on it as well. They're very good down south. They're very good in, say, Arizona. But the thing is that it has to stay clean, and it has to be a quarter of an inch minimum away from the product that it's protecting. And if it's laying on something, if it's in contact with something, then it's conduction. It's not radiant. And then also the thing you always want to remember, are we a heating season or are we a cooling season? And so if in the winter, does it actually bounce, you know, those same rays that would be warming up the attic away? And so then now the attic's cooler. There's all kinds of different opinions. But take a look at what Department of Energy has, and they'll give you actual numbers.
All right, Dale, thank you so much for your call. And here's an email from Kathy in Iowa City. We're replacing our basement windows, which are small and do not open. We're going to replace them with the same size windows that are vinyl with a slider option. Our current windows are steel, and there's a steel frame fixed into the foundation. How should we go about installing the new windows? Do we need to hire a professional? Is this something that we can do ourselves?
You know, those are the one thing that you want to think about is if it's a bedroom down there, you're going to have to make sure that you have 5.7 square feet of opening so that you can get out of that room, especially if you want to use these windows for getting out. I'm not really sure where they're at. In some cases, you can get a custom-made replacement window that will fit inside of that steel jamb. You still have a lot of conduction and a lot of condensation usually whenever there's a steel jamb involved with concrete and cold and warm on the inside. But sometimes you can attach those to the steel frame. Otherwise, you can pull the steel frame out and put a new wood frame around the inside and install a window that gets to be kind of where it might be past your certain skill sets. So you may want to bring in, some professional that knows how to do that, because when you order a window, there's so many different dimensions that, they have sash size, they have rough opening, they have masonry opening, they have all these different dimensions. And it's really easy to order a window, pay for it, it shows up, and it's like an inch too big or an inch too small. So you may want to bring in someone that is a professional to handle that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Mark is up next from Des Moines. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. I've got a question about an entryway that has, it's a concrete cap with quarry tile, the 6-inch quarry tile installed on it. It's about 8-inch square. And the problem, it was a custom-built home about 20 years ago.
Okay.
But when they installed the tile, there's about a 30 by 24-inch kidney-shaped depression in the tile where the water collects. And Is there any way that I could use, like, put in sleepers on top of the existing tile and maybe put another floor? I hate to tear up all that tile to, correct it.
Yeah, because, man, that's always a mess, tearing old tile up.
Yeah.
All those shards seem to get all over the place. You can put a cementitious type floor leveler and lay down tile. It's hard. You know, the downside is you don't know what's causing that.
Well, I think when they installed the tile, the original bed of mortar was just low there because it's such a large area.
Okay.
That's what I meant. Maybe
I didn't describe
it. So when it was initially installed, they didn't, comb the setting bed properly.
Sure.
So it's actually, and they're like they're the smaller quarry tile, like the 6-inch quarry tile. So they're fairly tough to keep level over that large an area.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm facing. And I've done quite a bit of tile work, and we've also done quite a bit of exterior concrete work, and I just don't like the idea of going in there and tearing it all out, but I'm reluctant to use the leveling compounds on top of that quarry tile, because that quarry tile has a little bit of glaze, and I wasn't sure that that would really correct the problem because it's not much. I'd be putting on like an eighth of an inch or so.
Right. Boy, it just make me a little nervous going over that. How big of an area is it?
Well, the
like
entire area is about 8x8. But
you know,
the depressed area is kind of a kidney irregular shape of about 3 feet by 2 feet.
You know, I think I hate to say it, but I think I'd tear that up and
see, but I don't want to do it the right way. I was hoping there was an easy way.
Yeah. Oh, there's an easy way. Just get a real thick rug. That's what,
okay.
That's what we would do North Highway 20.
Yeah.
I think I'd take it out.
There's too much water collecting there. The rug gets wet.
Good point. You got me.
Yeah, that was plan B. So.
I think I'd tear it up and just...
Tear it out and do it again.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
If I have just a minute, I caught some tail end where a previous caller was asking about how to match up old mortar.
Yeah.
Okay, was that for... Was the caller trying to repair just the joints, like in a brick wall, or what was
it? It was tuck pointing.
Yeah, tuck pointing. Tuck pointing the house,
okay,
and it was...
Was it the whole house?
You know, I think it was, or at least part
okay.
of it, and it, you know, without... seeing it's hard to
yeah I've had luck where you, like in a pillar or a column where there's not a lot of damage or a lot of mortar that needs to be replaced and where the brick or the stone is cracked if the mortar is still relatively good, you can use some of the old mortar in your as an aggregate in your new mix and you can come real close to that original color.
Are you using, you know, just like a silica sand in there to then is the,
well,
the
you,
base?
You want to, you know, be sure and use the Portland cement and use some of the old mortar to kind of color it.
Sure.
And again, you don't for a whole house it wouldn't be practical. But for example, if you're doing like an end of driveway column or something smaller,
sure,
it can be real effective for small areas.
That's
all right,
a good
Mark.
Idea.
Thanks a lot for the tip.
Thanks for your help.
Yeah. Bye bye. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Jane is on the line next in Nevada. Hi, Jane.
Hello. I have a question about my son's home. It was built in 92. Two of the bedrooms are over the garage, and, of course, the floor is quite cold in the wintertime.
Okay.
Do you have any remedies for maybe more insulation in that garage or the floor under the bedrooms?
How much space is it? A pretty tall ceiling in the garage underneath the bedrooms there?
I think it's standard.
Okay. Well, there's two ways you can handle this. The easiest way is, and it may not be the best, is to put, a layer of, like, say, 1.5 or 2 inch extruded foam on the ceiling.
Okay.
And then you would put a brand new layer of gypsum board, like 5/8 gypsum board, because it has to be fire rated ceiling. And so then while you're doing is, you know, you're losing about, you know, 2.5, 2.75 inches of ceiling, but then you're still going to keep your fire rating and everything. But it may not. I mean, it should, theoretically that should help, but then it also may be that you pull the existing rock, sheetrock down, and then re-insulate the whole floor. And while you're doing that, bring a heating and cooling person in to make sure all of the ductwork is sealed and maybe even sized correctly to get air back to those bedrooms. Because sometimes all it is it was installed correctly, but then the ductwork may have, maybe leaky enough or not designed correctly. To heat those rooms, it's kind of a catch 22. The best way would be to take it down and observe what you have and fix it that way. You don't lose any ceiling height, and then the nice thing is that's also a good time to maybe add more lighting or any electrical issues or changes for your garage or the
mm-hmm.
rooms up above as well. But then you can make sure that the ductwork is right, because you could go all that work to adding insulation on the bottom, and then it really didn't help that much.
Okay, that's a good idea. They had talked about a new insulated garage door.
Well, that'll help. Anything will. If it's, if you have a drive-under garage, and if it's freezing inside the garage when it gets cold, then then you're going to get an awful lot of cold in that floor, and it just hangs in there. So that will help, you know, without seeing it. You know, it may help and it may not, but a lot of times it's the duct work on those houses.
Okay.
We were in the 90s when we were building houses. We really didn't pay a whole lot of attention to getting the duct work right, especially on those drive unders like that.
Okay, so really the best process is to take down the existing ceiling, check out the duct work, and then re-insulate and put new drywall up.
Yeah, that would be the best, because then you can observe everything. Maybe there's been moisture issues that you can't see right now, because when we drive under a garage, especially, let's say today we're out driving in the snow and we drive underneath, you shut the garage door, and it's above freezing in the garage, that moisture has to go somewhere. And if there's not an exhaust fan in the garage, which most garages don't have one, that moisture is going to try to go somewhere. And a lot of times it will find an opening, maybe in that ceiling around a light or around a hole or through the garage door, between the garage and the house, trying to sneak in. So a lot of times, especially if a house, we're talking, 20-year-old house now, so let's take a look at it and see if there's any damage, and then get a heating and cooling professional in there to take a look at it.
All right, Jane, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and you can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Home improvement expert Bill McAnally is here today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nevy. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go back to the phones. Jeanette is on the line in Tipton. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Good news and bad news. I'm homesick today, so I can barely talk. So I hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah.
You sound all right to us.
Okay, the good news is I was home to hear Bill McNally.
Uh-oh.
20 years ago, I bought a house out in the country, and you know what they say, location, location, location. So it's just this beautiful 12 acres of timber. And the house, part of the house sits on the two-story part of the house sits on a wooden foundation. And when I moved in, which was 20 years ago, I hired an engineering firm, and I pulled down the walls in parts of the basement, and they were going to do core samples on the wooden foundation to check the rate of deterioration. And the engineering firm came out and said, "We're not putting a hole in that. It looks fabulous." Well, that was 20 years ago. And so I'm wondering now, what can I do as a responsible homeowner to check to see if there's rot? The soil composition around my house is sand, sand, and nothing but sand. I've sunk fence posts in. I've dug big holes to put in a water feature, and I've hit nothing but sand. So I know there's good drainage, and the engineering firm thought there was a good trench drain sitting underneath all of the foundation.
Okay.
I wouldn't be worried about it at all. Is some of the wall still open? Can you see anything?
No, I recently remodeled and finished my basement probably 2 years ago, and when I had that done down, when I had the walls torn down, I replaced the insulation, and everything still looked fairly good.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know what I should.
Well, my home actually about half of it, a little over half, is wood foundation, and then the rest of it is shallow frost-free foundation. But the nice thing about wood foundations is when they use the correct material and when they checked it before, if they said it was good then, it's probably going to be good for at least another couple hundred years. When they use, it's called 0.6 treated lumber, which means that it's made for being in the ground basically, forever. It's not going to deteriorate if they use the right materials. And if they built something back then, the engineers would have noticed right away that the plywood wouldn't have had a stamp. It's like FD, it would have FDN on the plywood for foundation grade, or AWWF, all-weather wood foundation. They have stamps on the lumber that means that that's what it's specifically made for. And I built one in 1989 for a gentleman that had worked in the chemical industry for a long time, and he wanted a wood foundation. It's a very, very, very expensive home. And he said, this foundation will be here, for 500, 600, 700 years. He said, when it's the right lumber and they use the right fasteners, which at that time, stainless steel nails usually, you're not going to see any deterioration. In fact, we've gone back to one of my best friends, his wood foundation. We built one in his house. We went back later and had basically the same kind of soil as what you're talking about, and it had drained so well, and we looked at the wood, and of course, there was no deterioration or anything at all, and I wouldn't have put it underneath my house if I wouldn't have been, happy with it. It's kind of a mental thing, is when you think of wood and you think of fence posts rotting and you think of, wood rotting, this is a whole nother animal is when you get into wood foundations. It's a completely different type of treatment process because of how much material is in there, rot-resistant chemical. So I wouldn't worry a bit about it. In fact, I like them a lot better than basically anything, because I can always remodel them. I can do anything I want, and they're extremely strong, especially if they're put in correctly.
All right, Jeanette.
Okay,
that's
well,
reassuring.
Because the engineering firm had said that where I would worry about it would be at the ground and interface, at the surface interface.
Sure, sure.
So in another 20 years, if I plant some flowers and see some rot, can I just replace that top layer?
In 20 years, if it's the foundation grade, you won't see any rot. You'll see
excellent.
Some discoloration, it'll kind of weather.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But usually we always covered that up anyway. There's a product called a Groundbreaker, which a lot of commercial guys are putting over wood foundations and foam foundations, and it's fairly inexpensive. So take a look at that, and you can cover it. We've used some fiberglass brick panels as well to cover up the wood, so you don't have to look at the wood. But I wouldn't worry at all about the foundation-grade lumber rotting.
All right, Jeanette, thanks a lot for your call, and feel better. John is on the line, and he's also got a wood foundation question for us. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Good. Hey, Bill, nice to hear you. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Hey, thanks. I always wanted to hear that phrase. Thank you.
There you go. So we purchased a house in Northern Iowa about 10 years ago, and it's got a wooden foundation.
Okay.
And I've been watching the exterior wall on the front of the house, and it appears, I've been putting the 8-foot level on, it appears to be coming out of plumb towards the top. So the top seems to be tilting inward.
Okay.
So that's one question for you. How expensive or what do I do to fix that?
Yeah.
The next question I got for you would be, duct sealing. What is a good, how do you, I don't know, I guess what's a good way to seal ductwork?
Well, let's do the second one first. The ductwork, actually, probably the best thing to do, and it's the messiest, is use actual mastic, fibered mastic. You can buy it at any hardware store, big box store, whatever. When we sealed ductwork on the last house we did, I got tired of trying to be a neat. I just got some gloves on, stuck my hand in there, and wiped it over all the seams, all the joints on the elbows. The long seams, especially when you pop the ductwork, it's amazing when you pressurize ductwork how much air leaks out of those, joint seams. The tapes, the only tapes that really are recommended are the ones that have a mastic on them and not just the plain silver tape. Just because it's UL rated doesn't mean that it's going to seal duct. So the mastic is the best for that. And then the wood foundation, here's another good thing about wood foundations is if it is coming in, you can go on the outside, excavate, pull it back out, and refasten it at the top. It's not like a block or anything where it's a big deal. I actually had a friend that forgot to fasten it, and he backfilled, and the section of wall came in. So he dug the dirt out, pulled it straight, refastened it, and he was done.
Okay.
So maybe just something didn't get attached at the very top. Is it parallel to the floor system, like to the floor joist, or is it where the floor joist sit on top of it?
The floor joists, I believe they're on top of it.
Oh, you're in good shape. Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, I got a concrete porch
ooh
out on that wall.
Okay. Well, yeah, you may have to, I don't know what happened there, but somehow some fasteners were let go or it didn't get fast, and you're probably going to have to cut a chunk of that concrete out and,
okay.
And excavate. But the nice thing is they are, you pull them back, you re-nail on them, it's just like day one. That is,
okay.
And a lot, what we've used in the past is metal strapping is attached to the side of the floor joist and then wrap it down over the top plates of the wood foundation. Once you've got it in place, you're not relying just on people toenailing the joist down.
Okay. What about, ductwork, the only thing I'd be able to get to would be what's exposed in my utility room.
Okay. If you had ductwork tested, somebody come in and check it for leakage or...
I haven't yet.
Okay, well,
I mean, that's the only thing I'm about doing.
Yeah, you know, there's some people use AeroSeal, a product, but then it sprays down the inside. But, you'll have to get prices on it and determine yourself whether, that's feasible for you. But he would maybe have someone come in and do a save test. What utility company do you have?
For heating, actually, I use LP, but for electricity, I use Alliant Energy.
Oh, okay. So you're cooling. You get a hold of Alliant and see if they'll come out and they can recommend a save certified installer. And maybe your heating and cooling person already has SAVE training. It's system adjustment and verification of efficiency is what it stands for. But they'll come out and check the furnace and make sure the ductwork is working correctly. And maybe what you can reach, will help as much as you can. Then you're just going to have to determine, well, do I want to, actually AeroSeal it or something? Is it really going to help that much?
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. And here's a tweet from Aaron. Are there tips for fixing squeaky wood floors when the basement ceilings are finished?
Oh, when they're finished?
Mm-hmm.
They do make a type of a real small head type of a screw that goes down through carpet. Now, if you've got, it goes through the carpet and you got to be really careful that it doesn't, ruin the fabric of the carpet. And, every time you go over with a vacuum, it pulls some yarn up. But if it's tile, you're kind of stuck if it's tile or vinyl. We call it character, don't we?
Right.
Charity? That's just character. But that's the kind of the bad thing is when you do finish ceilings, sometimes you're just going to have to live with something. But in the carpet, they make a lot of carpet stores sell those little floor squeak type of screw.
All right. Good to know. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. And this is from Ryan in Ames. We're working with contractors for a new deck construction project this spring. Do you have a preference in composite materials or brands?
I don't at all. They're changing way too fast on me.
All right.
Maybe look at the vinyl as well. Some of the composites, just check and see if they have changed their fastener schedule and if they require you to fasten from underneath and then what the spacings are, because that's a very expensive material and you want to make sure and get it right now. And if they've had any failures, just Google whatever product it is and then say, whatever brand it is, and then failures or recalls.
All right. You'll find the dirt.
You'll find the dirt. I like finding the dirt, yeah.
All right. This is from John. I want to install in-floor indirect heat in my living room. I'm comfortable with installing the tubing and all that. My question is about the insulation under the tubing. The floor is built on trusses. Do I use a vapor barrier above or below the insulation in the basement? Is there any danger of the hardwood floor warping in the living room? And how do I insulate around the trusses?
They're very hard to insulate, and what you're going to have to do is get back to the if it's a factory made or a factory brand of wood flooring, you're going to have to go back and check with the brand, because some of the issues we've been hearing is that when they do run the heat, if it gets too warm, there's issues with expansion contraction. Depends on the humidity inside the house, because then it pairs with the temperature of the radiant. And they are hard to do as far as insulate. Some brands, what they will use is they'll use a metal track which holds the radiant, and then they have their own specific type of insulation systems. You're just gonna have to do some research on it. But it, sometimes the wood companies say, hey, it's no problem at all. But whenever you're changing the dynamics of a floor, you know, when you add heat to something, something has to expand. And when you encapsulate it with insulation, we don't know where the moisture is going to go and what it's going to do to the floor that's there, especially with people's living habits. Some people like to keep it very humid in a house. Some people have no control over their humidity, and it varies from, say, 20% in the winter to 90% in the summer. And all those are variables that sometimes affects what's going to happen to that floor. Because if it's installed and it doesn't have enough room for expansion and contraction, you may get some buckling. You know, you may even have some that'll bow up on the seams. So you're going to have to do your due diligence and get a hold of the exact factory that's providing you the tubing and explain the situation that you have so they can recommend what type of insulation and the living conditions you're going to have with that type of heating system and the moisture level inside your house.
All right, and we're going to wind up today with another question about insulation. This one's from Doug in Iowa City. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question quickly?
Well, I have an A-frame house and, you know, high ceilings. And we had our roof started leaking this last summer. And, of course, we couldn't get a roofer in last summer because of all the weather problems.
Sure.
And we're having him come in actually Friday to talk to us about the roofing. But I know that I'm going to have to replace the insulation in one part of our house because it leaked all the way through the drywall.
Okay.
And I have to replace the drywall.
Okay.
And I was wondering what you would suggest.
As far as insulation?
Yeah.
I like, you know, and this is just personal opinion, I like the blown products like a blown fiberglass. They call it a bib system or a blown stabilized cellulose. Fiberglass bats are just they're hard to install correctly, so I don't like using those at all. And sometimes the surface might be a little bit too cold if somebody wants to spray foam in that cavity. So a lot of times, like a bib system works really well.
All right, Doug, thanks a lot for your call. And we do have time to squeak in one more question. This one's from Tony. He says, my house is over 110 years old, and it has the old knob and tube wiring. I want to rewire, but what's the best way to handle that? I know that's a big question, but he also says, I want each room to be on a separate fuse switch. Is that normal or standard?
I'd get an electrician to do it, just to say, take it over, because there's some new regulations that are coming out, especially for new homes, and you might as well go ahead and, if he's going to rewire it now, and that would include a new panel that has arc fault and GFI, ground fault circuit interrupted breakers. They have a combination breaker now that has both, and the panel, the new panels come so that they'll take those breakers. Now is a really good time to upgrade, and you'll have an extremely safe home that way too. I was just talking to the electrical inspector a couple weeks ago, and I would just go ahead and convert to the brand new required system. Even though it's an older home, go ahead and rewire it like it's brand new.
All right, and that's it's time to get that done too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is. You bet.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for your call, and
yeah,
stay safe in all that snow.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you're welcome.
All right. Thanks a lot. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there too, at Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to travel back in time to the early days of baseball in Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.